All right, we are going to clap our hands. Turn it out.
Take it back now, y'all. Crisscross.
Now kill your friend. Now kiss your girlfriend. Date your dad and kiss your mom and hug your friends and eat the dog and pile on. Go to sleep.
Crisscross.
It's like that Tim and Eric sketch where the guy hits the button while playing trivia and it just keeps getting louder. Crisscross.
Crisscross.
Until it doesn't sound like anything. Yeah. Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 5, Daisy Chats. My name is Alan, and I'm joined by a gifted boy. Not academically, not athletically. This man was gifted in a way that no other boy was gifted. It's Magellan.
Oh, that's... I think I'm flattered.
I think this is flattered. Computer, identify emotions.
How you doing, man?
I'm good, thank you. Wow, aw. You know what I realized? I used to always be like, Magellan, you never say how are you doing. You do, actually. What it is, I always am surprised. You just don't answer it. Not only that, but I'm always surprised when people care about how I'm doing, and it's so weird to me that I feel that. Right. Like, I know.
So it's not that I'm an asshole, you're just self-hating? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's both. Fuck you, it's both. It's extremely both. Welcome to Daisy Chats, the realest podcast on the internet, this side of the uncharted territories.
Yeah. We're just going to pause out.
We're just going to whoosh. We watch Pushing Daisies 2 episodes a week here, and we talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
So for this week, we watched season 1, episode 3, The Fun and Funeral, which we're going to be discussing first, and then we're going to talk about season 1, episode 4, Pigeon. Magellan, let's talk The Fun and Funeral. It was written by Brian Fuller, directed by Paul Edwards, and it aired October 17th, 2007. Magellan, what happened in this episode?
In the present, Ned hasn't mentioned to Chuck the cost of keeping her alive, and they almost kiss through saran wrap. A jealous Olive watching chats with the traveling salesman Alfredo Aldericio, who worries that Earth's atmosphere could be sucked away and treats himself with his own homeopathic antidepressants. Emerson comes in for ice cream, and Olive expresses her frustration to him. He also has a new case of a man who died under mysterious circumstances. Emerson, Ned, and Chuck, despite Emerson's protests, go to the morgue to check the body, and it turns out to be Lawrence Schatz, the man who died to keep Chuck alive, and was revealed as a grave robber. Ned leaves, refusing to touch him, and Chuck wants to know who the killer is. Ned finally admits that he killed Schatz. I know. Ned brings back Lewis, right? Lewis?
Lewis Schatz, yeah.
Yeah. Ned brings back Lewis, and he explains that he confronted one of the family members who had a Civil War heirloom stolen while he was eating. Lewis choked to death on the piece of tongue he was eating. They get him out, Ned kills him again, and they head for the funeral home, where Emerson gets stuck in a window. Ned finds a man lying on a table who is alive and wielding the Civil War sword. It's Wilfred Woodruff, the descendant of the man who originally owned the stolen sword. Woodruff thinks back to how his great-great-great-great-grandfather, Fambing Wu, ended up becoming a hero in the Civil War and getting the sword. Ned and Woodruff fight while Emerson is stuck in the window, and Chuck teases Emerson by referring to him as Winnie the Pooh. Woodruff thinks that Ned killed Lawrence because he ran out of the funeral home after resurrecting Chuck. Chuck arrives and Woodruff goes after her, but Ned trips him, and Emerson kicks him unconscious. Ned knocks down the curtain, revealing the hidden heirlooms.
Yay!
Yeah, I know. An unnaturally cheery Olive arrives at the pie hole with Digby, while Emerson decides to lose weight after considering the somewhat obese Schatz brothers. Lily and Vivian have the pie while Woodruff is charged with murder. Ned and Chuck send the heirlooms back, and Ned admits he would still keep Chuck alive, confident in his decision.
Aww.
Yeah, sort of. Sort of aw.
Kinda. I don't even know where to start with this. I have some problems with this episode, but I found it really interesting because they just did it. They just did the plot. They're like, all right, that's enough. That's enough fooling around, for which we fooled around for one episode. It's time to go somewhere. Like in terms of the Schatz brothers stuff, feeling sort of like a direct continuation of the pilot. I did not expect them to do that. What did you think of that whole plot line?
I thought that, this would be something that would show up later and not in episode three. I'm glad that they did it, although I'm a little... I'm somewhat glad, but also somewhat confused, because it felt like this tension over Ned wants to hide the fact that someone died to resurrect Chuck. I felt like that tension was something that was going to like bubble up and explode later when we knew more about them and when their relationship had already been tested to a certain extent. So it almost feels a bit premature that that came up. I appreciate shows that are willing to jump to the next plot point, because I think very often TV shows will kind of rest on having one hook for too long and not engage with it. But it felt early here. And because of that, it felt like by the end of this episode, we were left with a resolution that was sort of underwhelming. And it's just continuing to frustrate me thinking about the character of Chuck, and how she's just supposed to, she just kind of accepts at the end of this episode when Ned is like, hey, listen, you're right. I let someone die because I really like you and want to keep you alive. And she's like, well, at least you did it on purpose. You know, it's like, that's the thing.
Does that make you better?
That's the thing that she's happy about, is that it was an intentional decision on his part. And I just didn't buy that.
There's some really strong, like, surprising character moments from Chuck this episode. Like when they're talking to the Schatz brother in the coffin and they're about to, and it's kind of not the best way to generate tension, but you know, their timer is running out and he says, oh, it's not just me who stole the heirlooms. Like my brother worked on it. And then she sees the watch he's wearing and she's like, that was my watch. And he's like, yeah, I stole it off of you when you died because you're supposed to be dead. And she gets so mad that she conveniently closes the lockable coffin in a way that they can't touch him. And it just felt like they set that up to make tension.
Yeah, because it's immediately resolved, right?
Yeah, because you just get Emerson running out and then it cuts to commercial and you're like, wait, what the... And instead of dealing with that, they just it just works out. They do unlock it and touch him. Like sometimes I like watching this on CW Seed because we get to see where the commercial breaks happen. Mm-hmm. But I've been starting to consider just watching, like, I have this show downloaded to my computer also, let's just be honest. And sometimes I'm like, I should just watch this because these commercial breaks often are like ginning up something I don't need to care about, or like I don't need to be worried about because it's going to be resolved the second they end the commercial ends.
Right. It is a vestige of watching television shows from this period of time where there are just moments of, as you like to put it, fake dramatic tension put in for the sake of making sure you come back to your couch in a couple minutes. And it's just not how we do TV anymore, really. I mean, maybe it is how TV is done on networks. I'm not sure because I'm not really watching a lot of like current day network television. But like a Netflix original is not going to have a moment where there's something dramatic that is immediately resolved, because from a storytelling perspective, it doesn't make sense unless you're on TV.
Exactly. It feels like this show is often constrained by its network format, in that it maybe it would have worked better as a commercial-free Netflix series if that existed at the time.
Sure.
Because like I mean, I think Netflix was around in 07, but that was when it was definitely just a like DVD service.
But ultimately, you could say that any show would work better as in that format. Like I don't think there's any hour-long drama or hour-long comedy or whatever that benefits from the notion that it has commercial breaks,
because they're just act breaks. Like, especially with dramatic shows, commercials often undermine the dramatic endings of acts, because you know, you get the who could the killer be, and then we turn around and the killer has a knife on us, and then Dove soap.
Yeah, Cymbalta helps you to empty your nostrils. Yeah.
Well, Magellan, tell me what you think Cymbalta does.
It helps you empty your nostrils and get less depressed or something.
By emptying your nostrils.
Yeah. Which one is it? Is that
it's,
right?
It's an SSRI. It's an anti-anxiety depression medicine. Yeah. Yes. Duloxetine is the name of the generic, actually. Thank you. The funny thing is I'm making fun of myself. There's no character. There's no, like, other guy. That's me.
Yeah, you're self-hating. We know.
No, okay. Well, that's my brand now. I love it. Great. Good. Great and good.
What was I going to say? You got to help me out because I was going to say something.
Okay, I'm sorry. Am I being threatened? I'm trying.
No.
Don't go another second without helping me. You have to. I hate this dynamic. Do not continue the podcast until you help me reach my point.
No. Shit, what was I gonna say?
Talking about the brothers and the plot with the death and we're talking about like commercials and stuff.
Damn.
And act breaks and Chuck and the watch, and I mean, how far back do you want me to go? Welcome to Daisy Chats.
God, I can't remember. I'm so sorry. Continue your sentence. I'll do some thinking on my own.
I was just talking about how I waffle back and forth. The show is often very cute and then often really freaking frustrating because, like, them kissing through the saran wrap is like, oh, that's nice. They found a really fun way to get close.
I love that.
I love that. And then we have Olive, who continues to be a problem.
I think Olive becoming friends with the ants is the direction that I appreciate, you know?
Definitely, yes.
I think that's a good way for her to be going.
She has friends who she cares, like, sort of friends. We don't really know how much that relationship's going to blossom, but that she cares about and that she wants to help get better. I think, and we'll talk about this in episode 4, but the antidepressants thing is kind of, I don't know how I feel about that. And the fact that it's not frowned upon that, like, if we just, like, give them antidepressants without telling them, they'll be happy. It'll be awesome. We'll give them happy pills.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, kind of dark in a way that I'm not okay with.
Yeah, well, it just, it speaks to the, how delicate the tone is of this show, because it is trying to have that sort of fairy tale energy and that kind of, like, winsome European style, you know, whatever you want to say about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the version of this story where it's set in, like, a magical forest, that guy's character is, like, he has magic berries or something, you know? And so if the story is like, oh, the mean, sad ants are eating magic berries that makes them feel happy again, or that make them feel happy again, that wouldn't bother you, you know? But the fact that it is a real world thing that is taking the spot of something more innocuous in the fairy tale counterpart, that starts to get a little fishy. And it's a set of conversations that we haven't had to have on previous shows that we've watched, and I'm going to enjoy digging into the genre and the complications there as we go on, because it is trying to be macabre, but in a way that is accessible and lighthearted.
Which I think is a lot of Brian Fuller, and that this whole writing team is like kind of, that's their MO with this show, is like, we want it to be dark because it's a show about death. It's 100%.
Right. Yeah.
A show about, like, the technically, arguably one of the darkest things that we, like, that the human body can do is die. Mm-hmm. And it is also trying to, like, be friendly and warm. And the way that it plays with those back and forth is often really interesting. But again, I find the, like, making jokes and putting a positive spin on sneaking antidepressants into pie is, like, kind of pushes the line for me, I think.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I remembered the point that I was trying to make.
Yeah, go for it.
So just to backtrack to Chuck's characterization and the kind of moral conundrum of this episode, I was somewhat bothered by the fact that, I don't know, or I just kind of wanted to ask you, really.
Sure.
Like, the show seems to pretty easily brush aside the moral issue or the moral choice that Ned made by letting Chuck stay alive and letting someone else die by showing the person who died as, like, a bad person.
Right, he's a grave robber. He's a and here's the other problem. He's fat.
Right. So it's like this big fat guy, and Chuck is given permission to hate him because he stole from her. Mm-hmm. And that was another part of this that bothered me. And made it feel premature or wrongly positioned in the plot of the show or the arc of the season, because we're sort of getting an out from having to actually wrestle with the fact that Ned was willing to totally lie and conceal what he had done from Chuck. Mm-hmm. You know, like that should be a pretty significant sticking point between the two of them, that he like let a person die. And he just was never going to tell her.
Yeah, he had no plans to tell her.
And no plans to tell her. And that, to me, if I had been brought back to life by somebody that I was friends with when I was 8 years old, mm-hmm. and I hadn't known or talked to since then, and then I found out that they let a person die so I could live, I would freak out, you know?
And also,
try to get the hell out of there.
It's also not creepy as much because she likes him back. But imagine being resurrected by someone you were friends with in eighth grade, and then they're like, oh, I brought you back because I had a huge crush on you. And like, that's super fucked. If she didn't like him back, then this whole show breaks down.
But even her liking him back, it's still like, you know, it's not license for them to be tied to each other forever and to forgive every completely insane thing that the other person does.
Yeah.
We're made to believe that, you know, I don't know. We're being a little curmudgeonly, I think, and a little too nitpicky about a show that's just supposed to be about, like, fairy tale love.
Yeah.
But it is a little hard to suspend disbelief with the Ned-Chuck relationship, because we're kind of just being told that they are in love with each other, and we're starting from the point of they're in love with each other, but we're not really given any reason for them to be in love with each other, except that they used to know each other when they were kids.
Right. And they told us in a flashback in the first episode that they were each other's first kiss. That's all we know.
Right.
So what I really want out of the Ned and Chuck relationship is some acknowledgement that the stuff that Ned has done is really terrible, and him to have to suffer a consequence for that.
Right.
Because you mentioned earlier, like, they get to get by with this reveal and he doesn't get in any trouble. He still has the reveal of killing her dad.
True. Problem, yeah, you're right. That's true.
The problem is right now, if he just told her this, I don't know how close her relationship was with her dad. Like, I think what we need is an episode where we learn that Chuck really loved her dad and that they got along really well and that he influenced her a lot and she loved him, and like hard proof that her life would have been either better or dramatically different enough had her dad lived.
Yeah. Well,
but it sounds consistently. Yeah.
You saying that gives me faith that I forgot about the dad thing, to be honest, in this episode that we've been doing.
Yeah.
That gives me faith that will actually be a tipping point and maybe bring up this moment where she was like, first you didn't tell me about this guy who died for me, and then at this whole time since we were kids you never told me that you let my dad die. I think that's going to be probably the thing that we were envisioning of towards the end of the season, big splitting point that has to be reconciled.
Right. And that's where, I mean, I forget if this was something we came up with or a listener came up with, to be honest with you, but like, maybe that's where Emerson comes in. Oh, no, you brought this up. You brought this up last episode where you're like,
yeah, man. Come on.
Yeah. The best listener, my friend and co-host, Magellan, where you're like, oh, this is where he has to come between them and be like, no, but your love is valuable. You still love each other. Blah, blah, blah. All this. I really like seeing Chuck's aunts more, Lily and Vivian. I think they're awesome. I think those actresses are great. Mm-hmm. I love their costumes. I love the eye patch. That I believe Lily has. And was it not this episode where they're driving in the car? Or was that the second episode?
That's the second one, I think.
Okay, that's my favorite. That's everything I want to talk about. But we'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
Real briefly, though, just to continue the Olive stuff. This episode is where I was starting to get tired of Olive. And like her knowing another guy is kind of cool, but
yeah, I like that. I like that she had... I like that there are characters that are Olive specific or like only interact with her.
Right, exactly. And he's talking about the espresso machine, and it's this big complicated contraption in the corner. There's probably a lot of symbolism to be dug into in that whole thing, but I want to see a character on the show whose relationships aren't entirely, or like whose plot isn't entirely based around relationships. And so far, it's kind of just Emerson, who isn't like in love with anyone that we know of, and isn't.
But this is a show about
his relationship with like.
This is a show about love. I mean,
true.
I don't think you're going to be able to escape that necessarily. It's like saying you're watching Mad Men, you want to see a character who doesn't have a job. You know, it's like.
They did that, though. It was great.
That's about. They did?
Remember that whole season where there was the guy who didn't have a job?
No, I don't remember that.
And Don was like, you need a job. You need to, I need to get you a job.
Is that your Anton Chigurh impression?
I'm not allowed to eat ice cream while we podcast because now I'm going to die. If I flip this coin, you are going to get a job. Oh my god, I never realized how good of an Anton Chigurh impression I can do. Wow, I'm taking that one on the road, baby.
Wait, does he talks, right? He does have lines.
Yes, he does say stuff like that.
Okay.
It's because that actor has a good accent. I was gonna say
Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Javier, my friend. So yeah, there's the whole grave robbing plot. That's fine. We get that whole scene of Chuck being like, I need to give back all the heirlooms to all the people who got stolen from, including myself. And then it takes this really weird dramatic third act turn where we meet the guy whose great 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 grandfather worked on the railroads and accidentally became an Asian Confederate hero of the South. Mm-hmm. Just out there. What did you think about all that?
There, I don't remember what I was doing. I think I was having to finish something for work while I was watching this episode. And I sort of tuned back in to the sword fight with the Asian man. And I was like, well, how did we get here? What happened? And then the thing that I'm liking about Pushing Daisies is its affection for going on tangents, building the backstory of side characters.
Yeah.
It's something that you get to do when you have a narrator. I think we talked about this last time. You get to pack a ton of character development and storytelling into like a minute or 2 minutes. And then you're back in the scene and suddenly the scene means so much more because you know who this person is. You know, and that's definitely true of the second episode as well, when we meet the woman who lives in the windmill. But so I like that. I was a little, you know, I don't know about this one.
It's weird seeing an Asian guy do a Southern accent. That's just a really weird touch.
Pretty cool. I mean, I thought it was cool, but mm-hmm. also just like his great, 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 great grandfather was a Chinese rail worker named, you know, whatever. I mean, it was in the description, but it just felt like like they were in the writer's room for 10 minutes and they were like, we need a made up Chinese name. What do you guys got?
Fan Bing Wu.
Yeah. And that was a little weird. Mm. But the scene was cool, I think. And I liked that character, and I like that Pushing Daisies is a show that can start where it started and end up there. And that can just happen.
Right. That's just a like bump on the way to the end of the episode, which is also nice. Like, no matter what happens, what crazy characters they meet in the show and villains that they fight, we end up back at the pie hole and people learn something and do something new mm-hmm. and work on improving themselves, which I really like. I think that's a really fun recurring idea. Is that you can live a whole day and then come back to where you started and not, you don't like, not every big day is life changing, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's sort of the nice fantasy of a procedural like this
mm-hmm.
is, and this is maybe getting a little bit too deep for our show here, but just like, you can set out your day being like, I'm going to go to, like, for example, I'm going to go to the supermarket, I'm going to do this. And then whoosh, you are you find out you have superpowers and you can fly and you meet the villains and you do all this big fighting. And then you come home and you go to bed and you go to class the next day and you forgot. And then you're like, I forgot to pick up the milk. Mm-hmm. Like you can. And that is sort of like not a thing that happens in real life also all the time. So it's just nice to like see a world where consistency can always become, you can always come back to consistency.
Yeah.
Even if I think like the default state being Ned and Chuck flirt, Olive's jealous, Emerson's nits is kind of not the best. I want to see these everybody doing well and not just everyone except Olive.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that they get there in the second episode. I think they're starting to get to her improving in a big way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any other notes on this episode?
Not really, man. Do not.
It's a fairly straightforward one. There's some good lines, there's some funny parts, but yeah. Nothing out of the ordinary. I didn't bold any of my lines in this part, though. There's some bad vignetting. Again, like when they're after the sword fight, Ned gets like caught up in a bunch of red curtains, and Chuck looks down on him, and he looks like a prince. The narrator literally says she saw her Prince Charming. This show is in love with Lee Pace. Like they just love putting him in like, whoops, I guess I look super handsome now. Oopsie.
right.
Bashfully looking like a god. And I really appreciate the continuing doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my last sort of note on this one.
Yeah. Sweet, man.
In terms of trivia, I got a couple things here. In this episode, Ned's childhood home, which was misspelled in pilot, is now correctly spelled Coeur de Coeur, which, if we haven't said before, is French for heart of hearts.
Heart of hearts, yeah.
Can be seen on the envelopes of hate mail addressed to the Schatz brothers and on the tag of Chuck's pie. The name of the funeral home, for some reason, is changed from Coeur de Coeur Funeral Home to the Schatz Brothers Funeral Home. I assumed that was a buyout when I saw that, but I guess I don't think it was. That might have just been a goof. And then here's a fun one. I need to learn to pronounce his name. The actor who plays Emerson, I think it's Chai McBride. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Okay, I just found out it's Shy.
Nice.
I literally just listened to him talk about an interview on Hawaii Five-0. Where he's like, hello fans, it's me, Shy McBride. So there we go. Shy McBride had a butt double when he was stuck in the basement window of the funeral home. God, that's goals, man. A butt double? Are you kidding me?
What did you think of the resolution for Emerson in this episode where the narrator is talking about, like, he decides to change his life path because of the Schatz brothers, not, like, leaving his... whatever, like basically saying like, oh, it's not that he's gonna become a better person, it's just that he doesn't want to be fat anymore. What did you think of that?
I thought it sucked.
Yeah.
All right. I want Emerson to be more than the comic relief. That scene's just a joke. I get it. Like, it's supposed to be like, and then he just, like, it's exactly what you just said. Instead of learning like most people do at the end of this type of episode, he's just gonna start working out, and it's just him on the scale like, huh, I gotta do this. As it relates to him being stuck in the window and him wanting to like be more helpful and not be a nuisance, I get that. That's fine. That's actually character development. But as a joke about like he doesn't want to be like the Schatz brothers who couldn't run away from a fight because they're big fat men, that's super shitty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of like quiet, understated fat phobia that plagues a lot of the television of this era.
Yeah.
And of today, let's be completely honest. I always pick up on it. I'm just like, oh, you did do that. You didn't want to normalize it. Instead, you made it a fun goof. But it didn't ruin the episode for me. It was just like, ugh, yeah, we're doing that.
Gotcha.
And then the rest of these are just cultural references. Like they make Winnie the Pooh jokes about Emerson in that scene. When he's fighting, he's doing the sword fight against Wilford Woodruff. Ned says, I wanted to be a Jedi, which is cute. Mm-hmm. And then there's a part where Emerson references Corpse Ride, which was the 2005 Tim Burton animated film, which is like that was two years ago when this movie came out, when this show came out.
Yeah.
I always think contemporary references, especially network stuff, when the filming schedule is different, are kind of interesting. Because I'm like, when was this made?
Right, yeah.
But for now, let's get to some questions. We got some emails this week, Mitchell.
Oh, sweet.
Our first email this week is from our old buddy, Dax. I forgot what part of his name I'm allowed to say because his email has his full name in it. Dax says, greetings, Alan and Magellan. All I can say is, wow, this is a very late email. My apologies. And then he talks about how he did finish season two of The Newsroom. And when he was planning to get into season three, he goes, oh, wait a minute. Your show's already done. I guess I don't need to watch this anymore. So congrats to you for freeing yourself early. He does shout out Constance Zimmer, the actress who played Taylor in season three, as being pretty good. He's a big fan of hers.
Uh-huh.
And then on to Pushing Daisies, he has a couple notes about it. He read some stuff online about how it was fun and quirky. Same. I remember people talking about this show as like top 10 like quirky weird shows, mm-hmm. and I never thought about actually watching it. So that was part of what got us to watch it. Oh, and then he talks about LiveJournal, and he says, I was very heavy into LiveJournal, and I don't think it's bragging to say I was rather popular for my memes and mean snarky wit on good old LJ back in the day. Somebody whose username I can't remember had an icon that mesmerized me for weeks, and I finally had to ask where it was from, and they told me it was from Pushing Daisies. It was a GIF with a woman in it who slowly turns her head and smiles. Some words appear. I can't recall verbatim the words, but they were something like, over the years, in his mind, the sweater would be a little bit tighter, the hair a little bit longer, but the smile would remain the same. That's from episode two, I believe, the car with, like, Ricky Lindholm, and she's talking to the guy, and they fall in love. That's kind of I never thought about, like, the little cutaway shots being somebody, like, inspiring someone to make a GIF or, like, form avatar out of them. That image stuck with him for a while, and he says, enough is enough. You guys doing this show is a sign that I am going to start watching it. Hell yeah, Dax.
Nice.
I love getting our friends into new shows.
Party on.
Magellan, do you want to read this one from Hugo?
Sure. It's an email from Hugo. It starts, aw, Pushing Daisies, heart. I'm reading it as aw. Ah. Ah.
Ah!
Yeah, I don't know. It's A and a bunch of H's. I think it's aw, but it might be what you did. Long time no see, you guys. Got busy with life, fell behind the live airing of chats, and stopped sending in mail because... who cares what I thought of Freaks and Geeks at this point in time?
I do, by the way.
Yeah, me too. I'm still kind of sort of making my way through the backlog, but when I saw you were doing Pushing Daisies, I just had to jump back ahead because I deeply care about this show. Can't believe it's already 11 years old. Whoa.
Yeah.
Shit. I haven't seen it in some time, but just your descriptions of scenes brought back vivid memories. I'm typically not a fan of crime procedurals, but this is definitely an exception to the rule. Then again, it plays with the procedural rules by throwing them out the window and replacing them with funny, quirky things. As you said, most shows are about the will-they-won't-they in the classical way. Even Farscape, who threw that out the window pretty quickly, initially started that way. Instantly, you know Pushing Daisies isn't, and thus you know Pushing Daisies isn't exactly a typical show. Solving crimes through the dead has already been done before, Ghost Whisperer, True Calling, etc., but never in quite such a whimsical way. I think you're in for quite a ride. Also, Kristen Chenoweth is fantastic, and not letting her sing would have been the real crime of the series. Leo Chris. Yeah.
Isn't it weird to remember that Hugo was Leo Chris for like a year, and then he was on our podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I love the community formed around the show. It's bonkers.
Yeah, I love our squad here.
Our chatsies.
Yeah. It's not already from those two folks. You know, there's one person who's watching the show for the first time, one person who's fondly recalling it. I like that we're sort of able to speak to both of those points of view.
Yeah. And then speaking of people who like things, we have our final email this week from our friend Old as Your Omens.
Yay.
She, if people remember way back in the day, she's been a fan since the beginning. One of our day ones, as the kids say. apparently that is a thing the kids say. And she used to write, like, summaries of episodes and kind of, like, break them down plot point by plot point, which she liked. And they're really fun to read. So here she says, dear friends, new format. Woo! It feels good to be back. Before I begin with the actual commentary, I'd like to draw attention to this. This is a quote from the episode. 1 mile to the west. Emerson Cod was also not happy. During times of stress or anxiety, he liked to knit. Since the arrival of the dead girl, who was not dead, he found the stockinette stitch to be especially relaxing. She says, it is the best knitting-based joke I've ever heard, and I'm so happy it exists. But there is an inconsistency. While the narrator says, as he finished purling the row, Emerson Codd is doing the knit stitch. Both needles are up, and the right one is behind the left, instead of the right one pointing down, in front of the left like in a purl stitch. There we go. That's 118 words devoted to me being pedantic and salty.
Wait, so knitting is just one subset of the stitching?
I think so.
Oh my god.
I'm learning so much.
Oh my god.
She compliments the show's color palette and compares it to a 1950s fruit commercial. Yeah. It toes the line between calming and discomforting, which, hell yeah. And then her email goes into a character overview. She says Ned is the least trash man she's ever seen, with John Crichton being a close second.
Yeah.
Awkward, selfish, but generally sweet, doing his best. I'm glad he's the protagonist because I couldn't tolerate any other male in this setting with his screen time. She has a big crush on Chuck, who she describes as her wife. The ensemble cinnamon roll and very smart. I never want her to leave. She gets on my nerves sometimes, but because she's my wife, I can live with it. I actually like Kristen Chenoweth in something that isn't Wicked. You go, Cheno. You go. Her face is still weird, but I can ignore it. And she sings in episode 2. She also sings in episode 4. And then she kind of agrees with us on Emerson. Whatever, this is the token person of color. I don't hate him, but I want him to have more development. As a fellow knitter, I appreciate his devotion to the craft, and I also appreciate gun cozies. She also loves the narrator and wants him to narrate her whole life and be her best friend. She awed at the two monkeys kissing in the first episode and says, thank you, Brian Fuller, for toying with my emotions. She loves a good Jane Austen-style can't-touch slow burn. But understands that sometimes it drives people crazy, so this isn't the show for people like that, where you're just like, it kind of feels like a will they won't they, but it's just a will they won't they touch physically. The aunts are straight out of Neil Gaiman's Coraline, Mrs. Spink Enforceable, which is one of the more terrifying books of her childhood. Considering that Brian Fuller and him are admirers of each other's work, and Fuller later worked on the American Gods show, this is amusing to me. Yeah, that's the latest. I think that's the latest show he worked on, like post Hannibal, was actually the American Gods, like HBO show. And then finally she says, I want to know who did the costumes for the show, because the dandelion costumes are amazing, and it's really impressive that Chuck is always in heels, considering that they must be very uncomfortable, and she deserves some penny loafers. Overall, a good set of episodes and a beautiful start. I need to take it all in, and then I'll be back for more omens. This all is right. Cute. We have nice friends. That's what I would say there. But yeah, I think it is a positive show that's getting a lot of people thinking in positive ways, which is super good.
That's great.
Let's take it home, John. Let's discuss episode 2 this week. Season 1, episode 4 is called Pigeon. It was written by Rena Mamoon. It was directed by Adam Kane and it aired October 24th, 2007. We're getting into Halloween season, baby.
Whoa.
Where were you Halloween 2007?
I don't know, man. I dressed as Weird Al.
Oh, man. I think, yeah, literally the next, if it's 7 days from this one, then episode 5 would have aired on Halloween of 07. I hope it's a spooky episode. Okay, so, description of what happens in Pigeon. Chuck makes pies for Aunts Lillian Vivian, adding the mood-altering drugs. Ned comes into the restaurant with bee stings, and a romantic moment with Chuck is interrupted when a messenger pigeon with a broken wing dies. Chuck picks up the bird, names it Pidge, and tries to determine if it's really dead, accidentally brushing it against Ned and bringing it back to life. Ned and Emerson nervously wonder what is going to die to replace the pigeon, specifically worrying about a nearby squirrel. Emerson worries about himself and runs away. They decide to give the pigeon to Lily and Vivian since they know that they're bird lovers, which is a little thing we learned last episode. Mm-hmm. After a minute, another bird falls from the sky and there's no issue there. And then also, I love that this is my favorite thing about when I was writing this summary, is everything in the first like 10 minutes of this episode just happens really fast. Like, we're hanging out. I'm sad. There's birds. Bird's dead. Oh my god, a crop duster crashed into a building. Specifically, yeah, the group is shocked when a crop duster slams into the Broadview luxury apartment complex. When they check out the apartment, they realize that the plane and the apartment room specifically belong to a Conrad Fitch. Fitch, the man who calls himself Fitch, is an attractive man, unharmed, and even catches Chuck when she stumbles over some debris. Ned is, of course, unhappy because he can't catch her without re-killing her. The insurance company refuses to pay on this life insurance, believing that the man committed suicide. However, his widow, Becky Caden, hires them to prove it was murder, and the gang goes to the morgue. Dealing with the coroner, Ned interrogates the pilot, Braden Caden, who says his plane was hijacked by a man in an orange prison suit. Olive's plot concerns her hanging out with Pidge and the aunts and considering how to tell them about Chuck because she's apparently the villain of this episode. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that. Pidge had a message on her leg, and Olive suggests that they go to the pie hole for celebration after they heal Pidge. Nen and Emerson go back to the apartment and find a corpse in a trunk, figuring out that this man is the original Conrad and that the man who claimed to be Conrad is in fact an imposter. Ned barges in on Chuck holding hands with the fake Conrad, and they reveal that the man in fact had a wooden arm. I really want to talk about that scene because that was a whole lot.
Yep.
And then Emerson checks the background of the prisoner, determines his real name is Lemuel Weingar, who was in jail for embezzlement. He lost his right arm while shredding important papers and ended up with the nickname Lefty Lem. Lefty Lem, this is all important because the whole like jail plot is just the whole episode. Lefty Lem's cellmate was Jackson Lucas, who was an old guy who went to jail for stealing jewels that he never told anyone the location of. And then he told Lefty Lem. They go to dig up Jackson at the prison graveyard, and he reveals he hid the jewels at the windmill and that he told Lefty about it. Lefty gets there first, introduces himself to Elsita, the one woman who lives in the windmill. She invites him in, he ties her up, and rips open the stairs, finds the jewels. It turns out that they're actually, the real jewels, are in Elsita's fake wooden leg, because this show likes its little cinematic parallels. And so we get Olive, Lily, Vivian, basically everybody goes to this windmill, and we have the scene where Olive is worried that the aunts are going to see Chuck, and at first she's excited to do it and kind of ruin Chuck's life, but then she says, oh no, I'll be a nice human, and has this change of heart. And Ned, Chuck, and Emerson all get out of there while the aunts walk in. And then just some love stuff kind of starts to happen. Basically, Lem and Elsita fall in love because they realize that Jackson, Lucas, and Elsita's mom, Elsa, were in love with each other. Mm-hmm. And they decide that they are also, and they were like jail pen pals, and they both agree, oh, I guess we'll just not, I guess, like, well, we're gonna give ourselves up because we have each other. And Chuck and the guys arrive, Olive answers the door, all this whole scene happens, and then there's that great shot where the aunts, or one of the aunts, sees Chuck for like half a second, and that part almost made me cry. And then finally, Emerson captures Lem, collects the reward. Elsita promises she'll write to him in jail. Lily and Vivian share a pie while looking at Chuck in a portrait. Lemuel and Elsita continue their correspondence. And on the roof, Ned and Chuck dance while wearing apiarist accoutrements. It's a really dense episode. It's like a lot of plot. I don't think it needed this much plot.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not upset that it has so much, but I'm finding that this is a dense show,
yeah,
plot wise. They try to pack a lot in, which I appreciate, but it's also a lot to keep track of.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even bring up the flashbacks and the summaries anymore because they're just like one off things. But there's this whole thing about like Digby, when he comes back to life, gets so excited to see Ned again, but can't touch him, so they have this like childhood Ned and Digby come up to each other and try to hug. Like, it's all that stuff. Like, this is definitely a show that we can't fully summarize by just talking about because you kind of got to watch it. But
there are a few threads that I kind of want to pick at, but it sounds like you had something you want to just talk about.
Oh, not really. I mean, I like all of the, I think a lot of the plot in this is really cute, and there's actually good character development as opposed to the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Where I felt like we were kind of stagnating. It's like, oh, all right, yeah, people are learning. People are growing up. This is good. But the end game is kind of not what I was expecting. It was not what I was hoping for.
Yeah.
So where do you want to tackle it from first?
I think I want to kind of take a step back and think a little bit about ultimately what is the narrative purpose of telling a story about a relationship where two characters can't touch each other. Because I think that is a very specific angle to take on a show about love. And, I've been doing some thinking about like what you could relate that to. In some ways to me, it feels like it's speaking to, I don't know. It feels like you could kind of graft a number of complicated life situations onto the relationship between Ned and Chuck.
Yeah.
So like I'm someone who for the past year and a half or so was in a long distance relationship. And so in some ways, to me, that's what I'm seeing in the Ned-Chuck relationship, is like a real affection and care for the other person, but having to essentially like invent forms of intimacy and connection that fit the circumstances of your situation. So like them kissing through the saran wrap or dancing in the beekeeper costumes. On a certain level, visually, it's saccharine, you know, and I think the show is trying to be saccharine, but that's at least the lens that I'm looking at it through, of it is trying to recognize and celebrate forms of love that exists under unfair or impossibly challenging restrictions, and kind of show that, like, you know, if you really care about somebody, you can make it work. Yeah, I don't know. It's just an observation that I had.
Yeah, I think there's that was like my favorite thing about episode four was about this episode was how much of it you can relate very clearly, like almost one to one back to how real world relationships work. Like the scene to me that stuck out was when Chuck is at the restaurant with the imposter and holds his hand. It feels like this moment, like when you're in a relationship, and as someone who has not really been in this type of romantic relationship before, mm-hmm. I can say how it looks from the outside is people get into romantic relationships because they are filling a void that they want filled with another person and feeling a need for that person, hopefully as well. But what you realize when you set a goal like that, like I want to be with this person because it makes me feel X way. Mm-hmm. When you want something else and that person can't provide it, you kind of are quick to look for it and crave it in whatever method you can get.
Yeah.
So Chuck gets a lot of love from Ned. She gets a lot of compassion and care and sensitivity, but she'll never get physical contact with him.
Right.
And in a way, like her touching the other man's hand feels like a sort of like nod to not necessarily infidelity, but just sort of like seeking something from somebody else than your partner.
Yeah.
In like a way that hurt, like you see Ned see her through the window and it's, he might as well be seeing her kiss another man. Like you see jealousy when the other guy catches her and she falls, but you see like a genuine sense of betrayal when she's holding the man's hand.
Yeah. And you know, I think again, the kind of first brush reaction is like, oh, this show, it's so corny, you know, like he's getting mad about her holding a dude's hand. And also they like, I don't know, the Lee Pace and what's her name who plays Chuck? Do we know, what's her name?
Anna Friel? Yeah.
Okay. Lee Pace and Anna Friel, I feel like, have really great chemistry when their characters are liking each other, but they don't have believable chemistry when they're like disagreeing with each other, if that makes
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. Yeah, that does make sense.
And so playing out him being upset about the hand-holding doesn't really work necessarily, because he's sort of like smiling and looking bashful and shy through the whole, like just looking really handsome throughout the whole being upset about it. But like, I totally agree with what you're saying. You know, the initial moment I think is really, I found it really impactful because, you know, again, when you're in a situation where, and this also speaks to the characters later in the episode who have fallen in love and he's in jail, right? That's another situation where characters love each other, but they're in a restrictive situation that keeps them from fully giving each other everything that the other person needs. And so what this episode is about, or what that moment of handholding is about, is saying that sometimes you love somebody who can't give you everything, and you have to make the decision of, are you going to say, well, I need this thing that you can't give me and goodbye? Or are you going to say, well, I can give that up for the sake of being with you?
Right. It's a sacrifice as much as it is a like satisfaction.
Yeah. Someone. And like, yeah, Chuck and Ned are not going to be able to give each other everything that they need. but maybe they're going to be able to give each other more than anybody else could give them. And that's really what it comes down to. Like, that's really a realistic look at love, I think, even for a show that is very idealistic or very, you know, fabulistic or whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, on the surface, it seems kind of perfectionist, this show about my crush from when I was a kid came back to life and now we live together and it's amazing. But it does have this realistic side of that's not going to be easy. You know, it's not happily ever after. There's a reason that we, instead of the show ending at him bringing her back to life, it starts there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, most stories would end at like, well, now she's alive and we love each other and like things are going to be okay forever. But they're not, you know, being in love and being in a relationship, there's so much story that has to be told from that point forward. And there are sacrifices and maneuvers that have to be made. And I really liked something that Chuck says when they're in the car later in the episode, where I don't remember the exact phrasing of the line, but she essentially says, well, what we're learning about each other is that we don't just have one big problem. We have a bunch of little problems. And so we're just like everybody else. And like for her, that's like a nice thing, you know?
Yeah, right. It's a comfort.
Yeah, that they're just like everybody else. So that's what I learned from this episode, is that the attitude towards love in this show is really a lot more nuanced than you might expect from having only seen the first few episodes and having only seen the marketing materials for this show.
Right. It seems like it's a show that this relationship has to go well, but as we see, there are complications in this type of relationship, just like there are in any. And even though it is framed as a magical fairy tale show, this is still something that real people in real relationships can relate to. And I like that about it a lot, actually.
Yeah.
I wanted to also talk about, just the whole, the plot with the aunts and Olive.
Yeah.
Because I think, as we were just talking about with episode 3, Olive is the character I want to see the most success for, in part because I relate to her, and in part because I want to see women represented better in television. I know Ryan Fuller is a feminist and is like knows how to write stories about women who aren't just attracted to men, and that's their whole thing.
Right.
And a thematic thing that I noticed in this episode, not even related to her hanging out with the aunts, was she, whenever she interacts with Ned, is actually very touchy, which I think kind of sets her up as a really fascinating foil for Chuck. And what we learn is, like, Ned probably feels some actual comfort in not being able to touch Chuck. Because I think Ned is the type of, like, not necessarily neurotic, but just he wants to keep a literal wall of distance. And this is partly, obviously, because of his childhood having this power. But he wants to keep a physical distance between himself and other people.
Yeah.
There's a shot in the first episode where he first goes to the aunt's house and he puts his hand on one of the aunt's hands and they like kind of recoil because they don't want to be touched. And he realizes, oh, like not everybody wants to be touched, including me. I'm not the only weird one. Sometimes people just don't want to be touched because it feels weird. You know, some people have boundaries in that way. And yeah, in the first episode and in this one, Olive like tries to get all feely with him and it's played as a joke, but also he just like feels recoiled at the idea of like touching someone. So I think in a lot of ways, the Chuck relationship works for him, whereas Olive could never work for him because she entirely wants to give herself to him physically.
Yeah, and it enforces or reinforces a sentiment that we heard in Omen's email to us earlier in our episode today, which is that Ned is really a much different male protagonist than you would see on other shows.
There's
a very different kind of masculinity or, you know, whatever. I mean, here we are on the spectrum of between masculine and feminine. There's a different kind of identity that Ned is representing here that's not often represented in television, where he cares more about the emotional side of things than the physical side of things. And I think in most shows, if a woman were to make that sort of advance on a male protagonist, he would, you know, respond enthusiastically to it, I would imagine, just the way that like the characters are presented to us. And because I think it is a wrongful misconception in our society that everybody assumes that like men always want whatever, sex or something like that.
Yeah, or physical,
and,
yeah.
Or physical touch. And the show is doing the work of saying, well, that's not true, you know. It's not that men like always, it's not that men are like, you know, dogs or whatever, who always are like, oh yeah, this is great. You know, there are different kinds of men in the world. So I appreciate that. It does sort of bring us to critically inspect exactly what else is going on with Olive besides being the character who is helping to create Ned. But, you know, it's a different kind of man that it is not necessarily going to be shown to us in most TV shows. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I mentioned that, but also the good stuff that happens with all of this episode is all of her interactions with the aunts between them in the car and her and like Lily is in the front kind of tearfully thinking about Chuck, and then her and the other aunt are in the back just singing They Might Be Giants.
Mm-hmm.
There is the symbolism of birds in this episode and they're being like, oh, I think there's Chuck literally has a line that's like a birdhouse. And empty, there's something so sad about an empty birdhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Like she keeps saying these like sort of little lines that are like really profound and interesting and smart. And then just sitting in a car and just singing a really nice song, both works as an appreciation for Kristen Chenoweth's ability as a singer. And mm-hmm. also is just like, these are humans. These are just people in a car. There is no symbol. There's no like symbolism beyond right. the fact that it's about a birdhouse.
Right.
There's no like secret meaning behind this. We license 30 seconds of a song and we just sing it together because it's super fun to just sing in a car sometimes. And I really like the realism of that scene and the fact that like, yeah, you wouldn't just get a scene where people just sing a song unless it had like some secret meaning or like second significance normally.
Yeah.
So I love that stuff. Also, it's the most like Brian Fuller company on their bullshit to just license a song like that and just drop it and then be away with it later.
Yeah.
They do that. And then also regarding like the criminal stuff and Lefty Lem and all that, there's a couple lines in this episode about like gayness and the idea of like, and like homosexuality in ways that I always write them down because I always try to think critically about that stuff, but they don't feel to me offensive or negative.
Hmm.
If anything, they just feel like nods, like winks and nods to the idea that like, yeah, totally homosexuality exists in this world.
Right.
I think he talks about his bunkmate in prison and then someone says, oh, like, is bunkmate a euphemism for? And he says, not in this case. And it's like, oh, yeah, OK, yeah. He doesn't like criticize him. He doesn't go like, oh, I'm not gay. He just goes, not, that's not what I'm talking about. But sure, someone's doing that. And like, yeah, every once in a while, despite the fact that it's a network show, we are reminded that, you know, a lot of the writing team working on this show were queer folk, including Brian Fuller. Like, just they wrote a show trying to reflect their experiences within the confines of a program about a lot of things.
Yeah. And in the media climate of 2007, you know, that's an interesting lens to take on this show, because you know, our attitudes, our social attitudes have changed quite substantially towards the queer community between, you know, the 90s and now, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Where like in the 90s, I think that was really kind of the beginning of our modern recognition of there being queer people, you know, mm-hmm. in our society.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
after the initial gay rights movement of the late 60s and 70s, that kind of went, the AIDS crisis kind of, you know, pushed that underground a little bit, and then reemerging in the 90s. But if you look back, and we've talked about this, if you look back at really anything comedic from the 90s or the aughts, there are going to be homosexual jokes sprinkled throughout. I was on the plane last week and I watched an episode of Friends from like 2002 or 2001 or something. And there, you know, there are jokes about like, Ross and his high school friend, when they were kids, they would like lock themselves up in their room. And when Monica finds out it wasn't because they were gay, she's like, oh, thank goodness, or whatever.
Yeah, things like that.
Or like old Weekend Updates, even with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, they kind of like make weird references of like, you know, it's okay to be gay, but it's still funny to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I've been watching a lot of Norm Macdonald clips, and he has some, you know, had some questionable stuff. He had one appearance. I think it was on Bill Maher or something, where he was, and you know, I laugh at it, but it does speak to this attitude that used to exist in media, where he's like, yeah, you know, I've been really into these porno films, or my favorite types of films to watch, and that all the panelists are like, okay, Norm, and then he's like, but you know which ones I don't like so much? You seen these gay porno films? I just can't understand it. It's all men in these gay porno films. Like he's kind of like trying to subvert homophobia. But
just by doing that.
Yeah, it's still like it's hard to know if that joke is on the right side of that issue. And so the show does place itself in an interesting midpoint between, you know, the comedic atmosphere of the 90s and our current day, when, you know, only a couple years ago the Supreme Court defended the right of people to marry regardless of sex or gender. And so, yeah, anyway, that's just my long-winded thought.
It's taken us so long to get to even that ruling. And right. We still have a really long way to go. Like, I think homophobia still exists in a big way.
Oh, for sure.
And we've also moved on into so many other, like, ways of othering people and creating different phobias that have existed but have become more discussed. And, again, like, it's important to note that when you're watching this show from the perspective of someone who's in that community, from Brian Fuller, obviously, and his writing, a lot of his writing team. Go ahead.
No. Go. I think you're about to say what I want you to say.
Well, I want to link for the listeners this talk that Ryan Filler did at Outfest recently, where he talks about how, like, with all of his shows, as long as he was still under the like jurisdiction of a network, he did his best to make them reflect his experience as a gay man as possible. But he felt like one of his greatest successes was actually Pushing Daisies, mm-hmm. which, I mean, I thought it was fascinating because we talked about in our first episode how it doesn't feel like this show is being inclusive enough with who can fall in love. Like, so far, it's been a lot of, like, men and women falling in love. But what he describes in that talk is, like, it's not a sexually homosexual show. It's not a homosexually gay show. It's just it's like a gay aesthetic. It's the vibe.
Sure. Yeah.
It's the way people smile at each other. It's the color palette. It's the style of writing, it's the tenderness of its male characters, it's the like female friendships, it's all of that that makes it in a way a gay show, but it still isn't like gay romance, and mm-hmm. that is where I still take umbrage with the program.
Well, and I wonder, and you know, this is a theory that I'm positing that I can't fully know if it's accurate because I am myself heterosexual. But I wonder what I was speaking to about the Ned-Chuck relationship, how you can kind of think of it just generally as representative of any relationship upon which there are restrictions on the way in which you can express your love for one another. And I wonder if people who are, you know, homosexual or bisexual or queer in some way, if they would see that relationship and see some form of their own experience echoed in it. Because I think especially at the time of the show's airing, you know, there are certain social limitations on the degree to which people can express queer love in a public setting, you know?
Yeah,
Like Ned and Chuck can't hold hands because she would die. But if you are, you know, two men in 2007...
You can't hold hands because you will die.
Can't hold hands because you'll face... you know, people will look at you weird or judge you or something. And so I think even though the two main characters are heterosexual, I think that there are ways to see the queer experience in the restrictions that society or that the rules of the world are placing upon them.
Right. And it even comes back to the fact that their relationship doesn't feel very masculine figure, feminine figure.
Right.
They hold a lot more equal power in this relationship than you see in a lot of heterosexual relationships.
That's true.
Like, it doesn't feel like he is controlling her or like making decisions for her and that she is like getting in the way of things. It's just like they are both independent beings making choices.
Yeah. I mean, we can start to get into a conversation though about how she's sort of trapped into being with him and like trapped into not seeing her family anymore. In a way that complicates that, but generally I agree.
Yeah, and I really hope the show gets into that stuff. I hope that they don't forget that is under, it's under the crust.
Well, it seems to be kind of, every time it reintroduces Chuck in an episode, seems to be talking about Chuck really misses her aunts and wishes she could be with her aunts. So I think that'll come to a head at some point.
Yeah. And there's a lot of big stuff at the end of this episode, like, obviously, Olive choosing to not show Chuck to the ants is like a big moment for Olive, and I hope that means that she stops seeing Chuck as an enemy.
Yeah,
and that they can kind of grow together as friends. Hopefully,
mm-hmm.
We obviously get the scene where Elsita and Lefty Lem kind of like find out that they love each other. I didn't love this relationship just because it feels like, are they in love because of their parent, like? Her mom and his cellmate were in love with each other? Is that what's going on?
So the way that it's described is the mom and the cellmate are exchanging these love letters. And then over time, both of them die and are replaced by respectively her daughter and him, Lefty Lem. And they just keep writing these lovely letters to each other as if they're the original people. And then they find out. Then they find out, oh, it was you posing as the person, and I was posing as the person, but it was really us writing to each other. And I loved your letters, and you know, you love my letters, and we love each other, and that's what it is.
Yeah, it's another perspective on love. Like, you don't even need to know the other person. You don't even need to see their face or put a name to them. They can be role playing someone else, and you can still fall in love with them, and that's still valid and real.
Right.
So I guess I like that view of it. I didn't fully grasp that while watching.
Yeah, it was a little convoluted in its presentation, I think.
Yeah, because it just ends like, and then he goes back to jail and they continue to write the letters. Yay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then just finally, like, there's, you know, the shot where they, on Lily, the one with the eye patch, sees Chuck for like a split second and is like yelling, Chuck, Chuck. And then I believe it's Olive who says, no need to yell her name. I think heaven's closer than you think.
Hmm.
And you're like, oh my God, like what? The show is killing me like out of nowhere. It's kicking my ass.
Wow.
I'm getting owned by Pushing Daisies. Pushing Daisies. That's the weed show. If you smoke weed, you die.
Yeah. Yes. Smoke it up.
420, baby. Yeah, I think that's what I got, though.
Yeah, me too. I think that's the extent of it.
Here's a stray note. This episode has a lot of green screen in it and like outdoor shots.
That's the other thing I was going to bring up.
Yeah. What's your read on all that? Do you like that? Do you hate that?
You know, this is something we've talked about a little bit in our personal conversations. One of our emails talked about how the color palette in this show is amazing, and I agree with that. I really like looking at this show, and it looks completely unlike any other show that we've covered, certainly, or really that I've watched lately. I don't remember if we said on the show last week that Amelie is cited as a visual influence.
Yeah, that was in the trivia for one of the episodes.
Yeah. And so I'm definitely seeing that and appreciating that aesthetic. The heavy use of green screen is something where it's hard for me to figure out how I feel about it because it clearly feels intentional. You know, in 2007 they had the technology to film people in a car.
right.
Like, it's no longer necessary to do that in the studio. We can just get in a car and you can just film us. So it does feel like an intentional choice to green screen it. And I guess that's because it's, you know, supposed to have this kind of storybook quality, like the backgrounds are whatever painted in or we're living in this world that is kind of outside of time and isn't in a real place. So I can appreciate the artistic aesthetic choice to use green screen, but it looks bad, you know?
Yes.
Like it still doesn't look good enough. It still isn't advanced enough for me to not be bothered by it.
Mm-hmm. I think I agree. I just, when I watched it, and this for some reason never bothered me. I was like, yeah, that feels right that the show looks out of time and out of space. Like all of the thumbnails I had for this episode were characters staring directly into center camera, like as if the camera was an object that we were all like hovering around like moths to a flame or something. And like that is a specific aesthetic choice that they do a lot that I don't see elsewhere. And like people just standing straight, bolt right outside, and there's this like clearly green screened ground and background behind them. And it feels like they are almost actors on a stage, for better or for worse.
Yeah, yeah, that's true too.
And I mean, again, we can never fully tell how intentional that is because it's 07, and I don't know the person who worked on this, the like effects for this show, but I definitely notice it a lot.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to bring it up.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately the intention is just that we want our story to look like it has a backdrop because that calls to mind the same reason we want our story to have a narrator, because we want the audience to be consciously aware that it's like a story that's being crafted and to have affection for it the way you would a bedtime story or a fairy tale or something like mm-hmm. that. But from a technical perspective, it also looks it looks like the scene in Hitch where they're out on the river riding the river things. What do you call those? What do you call those when you're like on a thing?
Jet skis?
Is that a jet? Yeah, jet ski. Yeah,
it's you like hold on to it and then it goes really fast.
Yeah,
ahead
yeah,
of you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a jet ski.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I've never seen Hitch. Let's watch Hitch.
Yeah.
Commentary movie? No. Maybe?
We could, yeah. I love Hitch, man. I think it's also 2007.
Oh, boy.
That was the time for bad green screen.
Like people, that was the time where Kevin Smith was just the... Yeah, that was the time. It is now the time for bad green screen.
Well, just because in 2007, everyone's like, it's the 2000s. We know how to do this now, right?
Like, right,
this is the
right?
best it's ever going to look, so let's just do it.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Before we go on, I just want to... knock out these cultural references from the wiki page because there isn't a lot of good trivia for this one. The Dead Crow Falling from the Sky is a Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds nod, which is apparently the first of many, many Alfred Hitchcock spoofs in the series.
Interesting.
When Olive opens the curtains of the Charles home, she says, "A bird that stalks down his narrow cage can barely see through his bars of rage," which is a quote from, I want you to guess which poem it is.
The Raven?
No, what's the other bird poem? More recent.
The other bird poem?
Yeah, it's about a bird.
What's it called? Or what's the author?
Maya Angelou.
Yeah, okay. I know why the caged bird sings. I thought that was a book.
No, it's a long poem, I think.
The line is from the poem Caged Bird, but Magellan is also correct.
Ned says that he could avoid having a conversation about his and Chuck's many problems, but, quote, like the cat, it will come back, which is referring to the, like, camp song. The cat came back, doop-a-doo-doo-doo.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I didn't get that at all. I was like, what?
The way he words it is exactly the lives?
Weird. I don't understand it.
Don't listen to that song because it'll get stuck in your head for the rest of your life. It's the most annoyingly catchy, like...
All right.
This was meant to be sung by like 10-year-old song in the world, and I don't like it. Oh, I'm listening to it right now. No, I'm gonna die. All right, Majan, that's what we got this week. Let's tell the kids what we're watching next week on Daisy Chats.
Let's do it, man. Next week we are watching season 1 episodes 5 and 6. First, episode 5, Girth.
In this Halloween episode, Emerson and Olive track down the ghost, who's been killing the jockeys at the old race arena where Olive used to race as a former jockey herself. With help from Ned and Chuck, they try to solve the big mystery.
Show is totally Scooby-Doo, and I do love it.
Yeah, it's awesome. Then, episode 6, Bitches.
Wow. Okay.
When a deceased man, Joel McHale, tells Ned that his wife killed him after giving him a cup of coffee, he fails to mention that he is a polygamist. Oh no, making the case harder than it sounds, with matters only becoming more complicated when Emerson falls for the prime suspect, Christine Adams, and Ned is left contemplating starting a physical relationship with Olive to complement the emotional one he has with Chuck.
They undid everything we just said!
Yeah. Well, sort of. We'll see.
Sort of. No, that could be interesting. I'm ready for it.
That sounds exciting. I really hope that... I guess they're like dogs in the episode or something to justify that being the title.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I guess we'll see.
Waka waka. Yeah, there are. He's got dogs. Right. You got dogs. Meh. Magellan, let's take it to the plug zone. Let's plug it in. Joop.
Joop.
Can you give me a good Foley besides Joop of something being plugged in? Ooh. Oh, I love Existenz.
That's a joke for like 3 people in the audience.
It's the plug zone. Hey, dear listener, if you like our show and you want to support us, please consider backing our Patreon. You can find that over at patreon.com/chatspod. If you donate at $2 or more, every month we're going to deliver to you a handcrafted film commentary where Majan and I talk to each other while watching a movie of our choosing. If you want to back at more than that, you can get some sort of fun behind-the-scenes stuff. And after we hit certain threshold goals, we'll have even more shows and ideas that you can contribute to if you back the Chats Patreon. We love our fans.
Yes, we do.
You can also rate us on iTunes and your other podcast listening apps. And if you want to email us and get your email read in the middle segment, you can send those over to chatspod@gmail.com or @chatspod on Twitter. Magellan, where can people find you? On the online.
They can find me on Twitter at JustAFluke. That's JustAFluke. They can also look for my other podcast, Adulthood, where I grow up week by week. Alan, what about you?
I can be found on a couple other podcasts. One of them is The Garnet Wager, which is a show where my friend Six and I watch the Korean game show The Genius and discuss it. This week, we are hopefully going to be starting season 2 of that show, and we have a really cool, fresh new idea for how we're going to be playing games and becoming good friends while watching a fun show.
Mm.
Speaking of friends, you can listen to Fireside Friends at firesidefriends.net. That's a monthly podcast where my friends Ryan, Katie, and I talk about media and pop culture and friendship. It's very chill and nice. And am I on another podcast? Wait. Oh, this one. Chats, the television podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm on 3 total. I always forget. Because sometimes I guest on other ones. That's like that was my 2018 resolution, was to guest on podcasts more.
Mm-hmm.
So I forget that sometimes I have to plug all of them. And then, if you want to just follow me on Twitter and keep up with all my shit, you can do that at Alan Ibrahim. That's spelled AllenIbrahim. Oh, sorry, I forgot to breathe. Hold on. Thank you for listening to this episode of Daisy Chats. Keep on living.
Is that what we decided on last week?
Yeah, that's what made it to the episode, Doc.
Keep on living.